A wartime diary from Nazi-occupied Holland surfaces after nearly 60 years.
This is the same year in the same country as Anne Frank. So this diary really is a kind of fascinating complement to that as a different experience of living as a Jew in hiding.
That's Damien Searles talking about the 1944 diary of writer Hans Kielsen. He's translated into English. It's the first nonfiction work of Kielsen's that Searles has translated. We also air most of our 2010 interview with Damien Searles about his translation of Kielsen's acclaimed novel, Comedy in a Minor Key. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We all know the story of Anne Frank, betrayed from her hiding place in Amsterdam in 1944 and sent to her death in Bergen-Belsen. But there were many German Jews in hiding in the Netherlands who survived the war. One was a young man my own father sheltered in his apartment not far from where Anne Frank's family was in hiding. Another was writer and child psychologist Hans Kielsen, who died at the age of 103 in 2011. I met Kielsen in 2003 through his wife Marita Kielsen-Lauritz when I was in the Netherlands looking into my father's wartime history. You'll hear more about that in the second half of the show. We first spoke here about Hans Kielsen in 2010 when his translator Damien Searles came on the show to talk about Kielsen's novel Comedy in a Minor Key. We'll air most of that interview later on. I spoke with Searles again in October to talk about his translation of Kielsen's wartime diary, entitled simply 1944 Diary. Well, Damien Searles, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So this book, 1944 Diary, this is the third book of Hans Kielsen's that you've translated, but the first one that is actually nonfiction. Tell us who Hans Kielsen was and the circumstances under which this diary in 1944 was written.
Well, it's really an amazing story, both who he was and how the diary came to be written and how I came to be translating it. He was born in 1909, Jewish German, from the sort of eastern edge of Germany, and was a writer. He published an autobiographical novel called Life Goes On that he wrote when he was 23, and that brings us up to the early 30s. So he was one of the last Jewish writers to be published by the famous publisher Fischer before all the Jews were banned by the Nazis. And a woman named Gertrude, who he wasn't allowed to marry because she was Catholic, but who was his basically wife, and he would eventually marry her, convinced him in the mid-30s to leave the country. And so they went to Holland, where he learned absolutely perfect Dutch. He could pass as a native Dutch person. And he had trained as a doctor, but wasn't allowed to practice. So he sort of got by with this and that until it turned out that Holland wasn't far enough. So when the Nazis came in, he went underground. He went into hiding. And so 1944 finds him in Delft, staying, which is a city in Holland, staying in disguise in this sort of Dutch couple's house. And then what he's doing is, to help in the resistance, is he uses his fake ID to go out to somewhere else in the country where there's a child or a teenager who's also in hiding. He gives them psychological counseling, and then he goes back into hiding himself. So that's what he's doing in 1944. And he's also, by this point, about to turn 35 years old and is trying to figure out what he's going to do next. Is he going to be a creative writer? Is he going to just be able to be a doctor? Is he going to move to Palestine? He doesn't know. So he starts keeping a diary. So that's sort of the political story of what he's doing. The personal story is he and Gertrude, by this point, have a 2-year-old daughter, but they've been living apart.
And why is that?
Well, because he's Jewish, and so to protect her and the child, she has been telling the story to everyone that it was a German soldier who got her pregnant. And so that she is a non-Jewish German person with a non-Jewish German child. And so those two members of the family don't have to be in hiding, but Hans does.
And now he had, you reproduce it in the book, he had a really excellent false identification. Well, he had excellent false identification papers. And he actually talks about how, for the most part, he was able to go out and about under this false identity until a certain point.
Right. So there's some details I'm leaving out. At one point, in 43, he was in a different part of the country, and a new Nazi rule meant that he had to move back to, you know, the area where he was registered and things like that. And it turns out that the papers he had then were very amateurish, and if he had been stopped for a routine check of his papers, he would have absolutely been caught then. But back in Delft, he was connected with the resistance, and so, in fact, the people that he was staying with were part of this ring that, among other things, forged identity papers. So he got the best possible fake ID, and his Dutch was good enough that he could pass. The reason he eventually was in another kind of danger is because towards the end of 44, this is the end of the war, Germany's losing, and Germany is calling up every man, every able-bodied man under 40 to sign up for the labor service, which means forced labor in Germany, getting shipped off. So irrespective of being Jewish, it has nothing to do with him being Jewish by late 44, but as a man under 40 years old, he's in danger of getting rounded up. So at that point, he stops going around so much and also actually changes his fake ID from a birth date of 1909 to a birth date of 1904, which puts him over 40 by late 1944. So that's the danger he was facing toward the end of the year. But, you know, this is the same year in the same country as Anne Frank. So this diary really is a kind of fascinating complement to that as a different experience of living as a Jew in hiding, because he was more free. He wasn't stuck in the apartment for the entire time he was in hiding. And the other thing that makes the comparison interesting is that he's having an affair with a younger Jewish woman who's also in hiding a few blocks away. So she really is this kind of alternate reality Anne Frank, who is sort of inexperienced, curious, very intelligent and literary young Jewish woman who is in hiding, but also sort of burning to lead her own life and her own literary life. And unlike Frank, she survives. And not only that, has this affair with Hans Kielsen during 44. A lot of the diary ends up being about that.
And in fact, he starts a diary wrestling with the ethical question of infidelity. I wonder if you could just talk about this, you know, very complicated dialogue he has with himself. You know, he does love his wife. You know, he loves Gertrude, the mother of his child. But he, you know, I have to say, kind of takes advantage of this young woman, Hannah, and he's quite aware of it.
Yeah, you know, take advantage of is always complicated. He definitely, there's a point quite early on where he feels more guilty before anything has really happened, and then he gets caught up in it, and then he feels guilty again afterwards for having, you know, written all these poems to her, and he feels like he sort of used her for literary material. At the same time, he knows he's kind of beating himself up over it. There's a passage early in the diary that I was just looking back at where he says, you know, here he is in this situation. He could easily have he uses a euphemism, but basically slept with her. I wasn't lacking in courage, he writes, but this would have been a mistake, but now it's different. And then he thinks or writes, this possibility of doing the exact opposite of what I believe necessary to do or not do, how many examples of this there are in my own life? And I believe that this choice, you know, deciding to do the wrong thing, basically, isn't always the worst one. In decisive situations, I've often trusted that choice. There's a strange self-affirmation in it. It's not only vanity, as I often trick myself into believing in aggressive, depressive moments. So, you know, he gets upset and he criticizes himself for like, oh, you're just getting a notch on your belt. But it's not that, he says. He says it's self-affirmation, experiencing one's own self beyond its boundaries in a way, then pulling this beyond back within the boundaries. These are liminal experiences. I really am capable of genuine deep devotion then. When I look at Hannah, I know that I'm not only taking, even though I'm not aware of being the giver. I so often feel ashamed of having received too much, of being worse at giving than the other person. She says the same thing about herself.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we don't have...
Right, we don't have her side, of course.
Or Gertrude's.
Yeah, so it's a complicated situation. Yeah, I mean... I kind of want there to be a way for me to say here that different people are going to read this differently, but a lot of the evidence that gets presented in the diary is that, you know, she's very much in love with him and she is, you know, choosing. She's not this innocent victim who has no say in what's going on. There are a lot of parts in the diary where she really sort of stands up for herself. Now she is in a vulnerable position. Of course, so is he. So I don't know quite what to say. Maybe I will say one thing. Mm-hmm. So when this diary came to light in 2011, Carlson's widow, so this is his Carlson's second wife, not Gertrude, who died many years before, got in touch with Hannah Sanders's surviving relatives and sort of broached the subject of, oh, do you know that there's this diary and that your mother had this affair and so on. And Hannah had, who had survived the war, married a Jewish resistance guy. They moved to Palestine in 47. And so Israeli family, by now grown children, she had never talked to them about this part of her life. They didn't know anything about her experience during the war. They had never heard of Carlson. The first time they knew about any of this is when Carlson's widow contacted them. And their response was, first of all, that they completely approved of using her real name and publishing the story and all that. And they said that they were happy to learn that she had this sort of ray of light in the dark time of 1944. I mean, they saw it as very moving. One of the things she was doing in 1944 was actually translating Comedy in a Minor Key, his novel that he wrote during this year, into Dutch. She ended up being his translator. But her own family had never heard of it and never knew anything about it and were only able to read the book in English after 2011 when Mrs. Carlson got in touch with them.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Damien Searles about his translation of the 1944 diary written by German-Dutch author and psychologist Hans Carlson. How did she discover the diary?
Well, I'm part of that story because I discovered and decided to translate this novel, Comedy in a Minor Key, into English. It had never been translated into English. It had been totally forgotten. And I came across it at random and decided to translate it. And in the English translation, which the publisher released together with a re-release of his other novel, Death of the Adversary, it got a front-page New York Times book review rave from Francine Prose, saying both these novels are masterpieces. Hans Carlson is a genius, one of the world's very greatest writers. And amazingly, this is 2010, and Hans Carlsen, age 100, was still alive and around to enjoy it. He was sharp. He was suddenly being invited onto Dutch TV shows. He got to see this book that he had published 63 years earlier in 1947 on the front page of the New York Times in 2010 and being sold into languages all around the world and stuff like that.
So
that was, you know, a wonderful experience to, like, be able to help that happen. And so after 2010, he and his wife started sort of looking through all the archives, you know, looking through their papers, seeing what else there was. There was a sort of collection of some short chapters for what was going to be a memoir that he had started in the 90s but never really finished. And so that was kind of finished up and published. It hasn't been published in the U.S., but it has been published in English in Australia. And so they were just sort of looking through all the papers, and it was shortly before he died that they kind of came across this, but it was afterwards that they realized what this really was and also realized that the long sequence of sonnets that Carlsen wrote to Hannah Sanders also survived, was this other folder that nobody had really recognized were these poems before. And so it was after Hans Carlsen's death in 2011 that his widow sort of realized what was here and started considering about whether it should be published or not.
That's great. You know, and talking about poetry, you know, Hans Carlsen, I mean, I met his wife, and then I met him when I went to her house a long time ago. He was part of the Dutch resistance, as you mentioned, and poetry was such an important part of his life, but also a really important part of the life. I mean, this other group that got me interested in this, that my father was involved in, that was also in Amsterdam, an underground group that was protecting some German Jewish refugees. They read poetry every night. They were great lovers of the poet Stefan Georgo, who Carlsen also mentions. In this diary, he's reading Stefan Georgo's translations of Shakespeare, which are supposed to be some of the greatest translations of Shakespeare into German. So talk a little bit about poetry and why an art that seems to be so tangential in our current society was so important then.
Well, I mean, I think that's just a cultural shift. I think poetry was not just important to resistance members. I think it was important the way, you know, pop music is to our lives, or it was just how people were artistic and how people thought about the bigger issues in their lives. And that's, in a way, one of the most fascinating things about this diary is that it's mostly not an adventure story about being in hiding from, you know, the police trying to round me up and all the sort of news of the war kind of keeps coming up in passing. And what it's really about is his struggle to sort of be a human being. How is he going to have his life in these circumstances? What is it going to mean for him to be a writer? What kind of writer? He spends a lot of time in this diary describing how he's reading Rilke, he's reading Kafka for the first time, he's reading Baudelaire. And at one point, he says, this is kind of an amazing quote for a Jew in hiding in Nazi Holland in 1944, "Wartime events, however much they grip me, are no longer my real life." He says that what's real is the human being, the poem, people together. At one point, he says that all of this extremely horrific history going on around him is something to turn away from so that he can, you know, be a human being and be an authentic human being with the integrity he wants to have. And that's amazing stuff being written on the spot by someone in this situation, it seems to me.
Yeah, in fact, it seems that literature and poetry was almost a means of resistance itself. It was the both for him in this diary, as well as from what I know of the other group that was in Amsterdam, you know, this was a means of asserting one's humanity in a time when there was a regime that was trying to assert your inhumanity or lack of humanity.
I think that's right.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Damien Searles about his translation of the 1944 diary of Hans Kielsen. Now, he also writes that the diary is his only chance to escape the lies, as he says. What do you think he's referring to there?
I think that, you know, he finds himself in this difficult situation, mostly in terms of falling for this woman while he's in hiding away from his life partner. And he is, you know, one of these people who's very penetrating and honest with himself and tries to be with other people, but knows that honesty isn't always the best policy. I mean, sometimes, I think we all know this from our own personal lives, you can tell yourself you're being honest to give yourself an excuse to say something mean to someone, that you're not doing anyone any favors, you're just being aggressive. And on top of being aggressive, you're being self-righteous and pretending that you're doing it to be noble. You know, and he is definitely self-aware enough to realize this. So he's in this fraught situation. He is confused about his own life and is, you know, dealing with these complexities. And so he at least starts the diary as a way to sort of clear his head and just sort of get down on paper stuff that even if he isn't going to say to the people involved, at least he gets to say it to himself. And, I mean, I think that's a very natural impulse for a diary keeper. Like, this is my one chance where I can just be honest and be open and sort of figure out how I really feel about things in a situation where I'm not involving someone else by talking it out with them or whatever. You know, he and Gertrude seem, from the evidence of this diary, which is sort of all we have, to have been quite honest with each other. I mean, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about this as a document is that it really does get you behind the closed doors of a marriage in some ways more than most other documents do. He is not the cliche of sowing his wild oats while the old lady's out of town. Like, that's not what's going on in that kind of simple way. It probably never is in real life, but you certainly get a lot of his love for Gertrude in this book, a lot of what he really admires about her, as well as what the source of their problems are, and, you know, which ones come from him and which ones come from her as he sees it. So it's very fascinating on that level.
Now, as you said, most of the diary is really involved with his creative life and his emotional life, his romantic life, but also the war does come in at certain points. And on Wednesday, October 18th, 1944, he writes about the mass murders in Poland. He writes about the mass murders in the Polish concentration camps with gas. You know, so many people claim that, oh, they didn't know anything until after the war, until the camps were liberated. But it, very clearly, someone who was in hiding in Amsterdam during the war didn't know about these. Talk a little bit about how he processes, you know, this whole catastrophe that's happening to Jews in Poland and to you.
Yeah, the thing that's worth mentioning there is that he and Gertrude had gotten out of Germany in the mid-30s. He got his parents out in the late 30s, but they had been arrested and sent east, and he never saw them again. So it's not just general or historical about the gassing in Poland. That's his parents he's talking about. And that is this sort of gaping underlying wound that he doesn't really talk about directly very much in the diary, but is, you know, the huge trauma of his life, that he loses his parents to Auschwitz. So everything that's going on in this book is sort of revolving around that, no matter how unspoken it is. One of the kind of amazing sequences is where he kind of daydreams about signing up voluntarily for this labor roundup so that he can be sent back to Germany, so that he, pretending to be a German doctor, can witness the downfall with his own eyes and, like, be there and see them all lose, and what that would be like, what a triumph that would be to be this unknown enemy observer watching them go down. I mean, it's this kind of crazy fantasy where he realizes how insane it would be, after having survived this long, to sort of voluntarily put himself in the enemy hands. But it's this combination of survivor guilt and sort of wanting to punish himself, but also wanting this revenge in a writerly way, getting to see the downfall and describe it. He imagines at one point doing it himself, and then he also imagines what a great novel it would be about a Jew in hiding who voluntarily goes back at the end of the war so that he can witness everything. So, you know, there's all this very intense personal feeling swirling around everything that's going on in his life.
Hmm. So just finally, now, the last part of the book are the poems that he wrote to Hannah. So you've translated, how many poems are there, 60?
There are 46.
46 poems. Just talk a little bit about maybe the issues of translation of poetry. I mean, it's one thing to translate prose, but poetry is trickier.
Yeah. So, you know, Hans Carlsen thought of himself as a poet. Even towards the end of his life, when the novels got success, he sort of, as we were talking about before, he felt that this was his sort of vocation. This was art. This is the way. I guess it's sort of similar to now, how if people write novels and short stories, they still would think of themselves as a novelist, because that's the major form. And so he thought of himself as a poet, and remained very proud of his poetry and worked very hard at his poetry. So that's in a way why they're in this book, which is a diary, because they are his sort of spiritual autobiography as he's going through this year of his life. So, yeah, I decided to translate them and include them. They're also included in the German and the Dutch editions. And I've translated poetry before, but this is one of the harder kinds of poetry to translate, because it's this very formal, controlled, rhyming sonnets. And you always have to decide, you know, how important the rhymes are, and is it even possible to get them, and can you get them some other way? In the case of these poems, I think it was very important to Marita Carlsen-Loritz, and also to me, to, on the one hand, this was his first poetry that was coming into English, and so you want to really show it for the poetry it is. On the other hand, it is these historical documents and autobiographical documents. So the freedom you have to sort of tinker with some of the language to get the poetic qualities across is sort of balanced by the fact that you want to be much more literal with this kind of historical document poem than you would necessarily be with just a poem in general. So I did, though, translate them as poetry. I paid attention to the language, and if not rhymes, tried to get a sort of blank verse meter across and keep some of the elevated language of the poems and things like that. In the German, his style is very kind of cramped and well-wrought, and he sort of drops endings or plays with the word order or does things that make the reader in German have to kind of really pay attention and decipher and slow down. It's not trying to be conversational and readable. It's trying to be sort of elevated and poetic. So that's the kind of thing I tried to bring across, even when I couldn't exactly do a rhyme scheme, of course.
And there are some rhymes. I thought you did an excellent job with that, as well as with, you know, the whole the translation of the whole diary. So, Damien Searles, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about 1944 Diary by Hans Kielsen. It's just such a rich read. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
After the break, we'll hear my 2010 interview with Searles about his award-winning translation of Hans Kielsen's novel, Comedy in a Minor Key. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with Damien Searles, translator of the works of Hans Kielsen, among other authors. Back in 2010, I spoke with Searles about Comedy in a Minor Key, a novel by Kielsen that was widely hailed as a masterpiece when it was released into English after more than 50 years. Here's that interview now. When the email preview of the New York Times book review landed in my inbox several months ago, I nearly fell off my chair. There was a review by Francine Prose of two novels by Hans Kielsen that have just been reissued by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. She wrote, "For busy, harried, or distractible readers who have the time and energy only to skim the opening paragraph of a review, I'll say this as quickly and clearly as possible. The Death of the Adversary and Comedy in a Minor Key are masterpieces, and Hans Kielsen is a genius." The centenarian author is married to a friend of mine, and the last time I was in the Netherlands, they graciously hosted me for several days in their home in a small town near Amsterdam. So I fired off an excited email to Marita, my friend, who told me that, yes, she and Hans were quite surprised when they were contacted by our first guest on today's program, translator Damien Searles, about Hans's novel Comedy in a Minor Key. Hans Kielsen came to the Netherlands in the 1930s. A German Jew, he saw the writing on the wall when Hitler came to power. When the Nazis invaded the Netherlands, Kielsen went underground. After the war, he published Comedy in a Minor Key in his native German, and in 1962, The Death of the Adversary was translated into English and published in the U.S. to rave reviews. Now they've both been reissued by FSG, with Comedy in a Minor Key brilliantly translated by Damien Searles. But before we begin our conversation with Searles, I should tell you how I made Hans Kielsen's acquaintance. I've mentioned before on this show that my father, Guido Tennyson, was part of an underground group in Amsterdam during the war. When the war ended, the group emerged from hiding, taking the name Castrum Peregrini, or Pilgrim's Castle. It's what they called their refuge during the war. Castrum Peregrini became a publishing house and a journal, and Marita Kielsen joined it soon after the war as a young woman. When I began researching my father's history, I met her, and she became a friend. She met Hans Kielsen in the course of her work, and they've been happily married for decades. Now, let's return to the story of Hans Kielsen, his novella Comedy in a Minor Key, and our conversation with the translator, Damien Searles. Damien Searles, I want to welcome you to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
I was thrilled to see in the New York Times Book Review that Hans Kielsen's book, Comedy in a Minor Key, had been published for the first time in English. What year was it written?
I've heard different things about whether it was also started during the war itself, along with his other novel that's just been republished, Death of the Adversary. He started Death of the Adversary while he was in hiding during World War II in Holland and buried part of the manuscript underground, like literally in the soil, for safekeeping and collected it again after the war. I've heard different things about whether Comedy in a Minor Key was started then too, but it was published in 1947, 63 years ago, same year as Anne Frank's diary, as a matter of fact. So he wrote it and finished it quite quickly after World War II ended.
And it was a bestseller in the U.S. when it got translated. Is that right?
Death of the Adversary was a bestseller in the U.S. when it was translated. That was published in 1959 for the first time and did not do well
in Germany was quite hated, and Israel did not make much of an impression anywhere except in the U.S., where it was a Time magazine book of the year in 1962 and a brief bestseller, but then completely fell off the radar. 3 years ago, nobody had heard of it. It wasn't in libraries. There was no information about it online, nothing.
And what happened to Comedy in a Minor Key?
Comedy in a Minor Key was never translated. It was published, as I say, in 1947 by a German language publisher for books in exile called Querido. They stayed active during the war itself and managed to have some kind of cover organization that let them stay in business, and they published a lot of German language stuff in exile. So Comedy came out in 1947 in that press. It didn't come out with Fischer, his German publisher, until 1988, and it was just never translated. I don't think it's been translated into Dutch yet, although now it's going to be next year, and never translated into English. I found the copy of the German book in a bargain bin in Austria 3 years ago, completely by accident.
This is an amazing story. Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. Why were you in Austria? What you were looking for then, and how this book, so excited you, came into your hands?
Well, I'm a writer and a translator. I mostly translate from German, although I also do translate from a few other European languages. And my wife and I were spending a year in a few various places in Europe. We were in Klagenfurt, Austria, because in the past I've translated books by and also about a very, very great Austrian writer named Ingeborg Bachmann, who is from Klagenfurt. And so I had a connection there, and I was in a sort of writer's studio for a couple months in 2007. And this was literally a box, a bargain bin, outside a Yugoslavian specialty bookstore. Klagenfurt is near the border of now Slovenia. So I was flipping through it, and in fact, there's a movie called Romance in a Minor Key that's mentioned in Ingeborg Bachmann's wonderful, wonderful autobiographical story, Youth in an Austrian Town, which is about Klagenfurt. So I saw Comedy in a Minor Key, and was confused and thought it was Romance in a Minor Key. So that's why I picked it up out of the bin and quickly realized that this was not the book that the Bachmann movie was about. But it looked interesting, and so I bought it for a euro or whatever it was, and that was how I found it.
And what did you think about it as you read it?
It was a different side of things about World War II and about the Holocaust. And I certainly did not expect that I would be running into new angles on that. There have been so many books and movies and histories. And, you know, I'm not a specialist on that per se, but I had certainly read my share of them and seen my share of movies. And this was something different because it didn't end in the concentration camp. So the story of Comedy in a Minor Key, I'll try not to give away too much of the plot, but the setup is that it takes place in World War II in Holland, and an ordinary young Dutch couple, Wim and Marie, have decided to take a Jewish man into their house and hide him, let him go into hiding in their house during the war. And you find out right at the beginning of the book that this man, who's known as Nico, short for Nicodemus, has died of natural causes in their house. And so now what are they going to do with the body? Because they still can't get caught posthumously, but now, of course, they can't keep the body in the house. So what are they going to do? And the thing about that structure, where it's a comedy, where he doesn't get deported, is that it lets Kyleson really show in flashback. Most of the book is flashback about the year or so when Nico was in hiding in their house. And you really get to see what it was like, how Wim is not a political person, but he sort of gets convinced to take this guy in, how Marie is just this Dutch housekeeper and has this stranger in her house for a year and meanwhile can't wash the pots properly because you can't get good sponges during the war. And it's really this amazing insight into what life was really like, not just for Nico, but also for the Dutch people who were hiding him. And because it's not overshadowed by, in the end, he got shipped off to Auschwitz, you get to really experience it in a way that I hadn't ever seen before.
We're speaking with translator Damon Searles. The book he's translated is Comedy in a Minor Key by Hans Kielsen. What's also amazing is that in some way this wartime fiction became a post-war fact. He became a psychiatrist. His dissertation is the definitive work on war orphans, on the psychology of war orphans.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cliche to mention Chekhov whenever you're talking about a writer who's also a doctor, but it's pretty hard to avoid it in Carlson's case because the fiction is so empathetic and able to get inside the heads of people in very different positions from him. You would expect that a Jewish writer in hiding during the war would write a book about what it's like to be a Jew in hiding during the war. But in fact, Comedy in a Minor Key is at least as much about what it's like to be Dutch people hiding a Jew during the war. And then Death of the Adversary is an even more startling leap in a way, because it's about the sort of symbiosis between the persecutor and the persecuted, between the Jews and Hitler or the Nazis in general, and about the ways in which they share certain psychological bonds with each other that are quite powerful.
When I stayed with Hans and Marita Kielsen in 2004, I noticed Kielsen's dissertation about the traumatic effects of the war on Jewish children. I began to read it and was impressed by its compassion and humanity.
It really is amazing. And the fact that he is directing his empathetic and compassionate gaze on the Dutch people who were not persecuted, or in fact, even on the Nazis, the persecutors themselves, makes it that much more remarkable. I've looked at his dissertation. It has been translated into English and is, you know, available in some university libraries. It's called Sequential Traumatization, which is a bit of an off-putting title to non-specialists in psychology. And the book itself is pretty technical and dry, except for the fact that he has dozens of little case studies in there. So the reason it's called Sequential Traumatization is that he really pioneered the idea that trauma isn't just a one-time traumatic event that you suffer from afterwards. It can be a narrative. It can be a story. It can be a series of events that build on each other and sort of create a track that someone's life is going to follow or not follow from there on out. It's a sequence. And, of course, once you've heard that, it makes sense, because if you have an abusive parent, or if you are in hiding from the Nazis and first, you know, this person leaves your life and then you go into hiding and then you have these problems with your foster parents and then you hear the news about this or that, it's a whole sequence of things. So what his book is about is how to understand traumatization as a story, basically. And so he gives case studies of dozens of children who, say, lost their parents or went into hiding at different ages, and how it makes a difference whether they experience it as a 4-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old. And the stories themselves are these very moving little vignettes. Of course, they're non-fictional. They're case studies for his psychiatry book. But at the same time, they are these very moving and striking little stories of the Dutch children. So after the war, for decades, he worked with them and treated them and interviewed them. He met with, I've heard the number as 204 of the Dutch Jewish survivors of World War II. Barely 2,000 Dutch Jewish children survived. The rest were killed. And he met with over 200 of them. And that was the basis of this, of his dissertation, his psychology book.
I'm talking with Damon Searles. He's translated Hans Kielsen's novella, Comedy in a Minor Key, into English, and it's just been published by FSG, along with Kielsen's novel, The Death of the Adversary. Kielsen, a German Jew in wartime Holland, first went underground and then joined the resistance. Now, the portrayal, on the one hand, the irony, the comedy even, of the portrayal of the psychology of these rescuers is really striking because, on the one hand, it's a very penetrating insights that he makes into their character, but insights that are made with also here a deep empathy. Describe, for example, Marie, what her feelings are about Nico and how they change after he's died, what she finds about herself.
Well, Marie is a young woman. It's never quite said exactly, but I picture her as being around 24 or 25 years old and has been married a couple years and is a good Dutch housewife. She does laundry and cooks and keeps the house in order while her husband goes to work. And if you've ever seen Dutch still life paintings or spent time in Holland yourself, you can have a picture in your mind of this domestically centered woman. What's more domestic than a Dutch housewife in a Dutch still life painting? That's what Marie starts from. And so she is a bit nervous about having this stranger come into her house and live there for a year in the upstairs room. And neither she nor her husband really know what that involves. At first, they don't know who they can tell and who they can't tell, and they sort of get used to it over time. But here she is with this stranger living in her house and coming downstairs for meals and spending most of the time kind of locked away up in his room. And then as the year goes on that he spends there, of course they, on the one hand, become closer and get to know each other a bit better, and the whole situation normalizes itself a bit. But on the other hand, this isn't the kind of book where any of the characters are these sort of cartoon cutouts of heroic resistance fighters. You know, it's still always a bit awkward having this guy in the house. They never really understand each other. Even though Kalfin is so empathetic and able to understand, he doesn't give that quality to all of his characters. So they don't really know what Judaism is about. At one point she asks him, you know, why didn't you just convert? You know, why do you let yourself be hunted like this? I mean, she can't really see the relationships between Nazis and Jews. She just hasn't thought about it. She's just this ordinary person living her life. And then it's only after he dies that she, in a way, starts to really understand him. There are two important things that happen. One is that she finds a packet of expensive tobacco that he's kept hidden from them. Of course, you can't get tobacco during the war. You can, if you're lucky, only get the really cheap, disgusting stuff. And so at first, she's a little shocked that he had been so ungrateful and he'd kept this secret from them. And, you know, her husband would have loved a good cigarette like this. And how could he do this to them? She has this very natural reaction of resenting him. And then the light kind of dawns for her and she realizes, you know, he needed to have something of his own that wasn't shared, that was private, that was his secret, that wasn't entirely due to this Dutch couple taking them in. Because how can you live like that if you owe everything to these other people?
So she remembers this about him. It's a very poignant moment. And I also was struck by the fact that she imagines him sitting in his terror, in the depression. You know, here he's confined in this room. He cannot go out. In fact, there is a point in which he does go out. She has left some soup to burn. She forgot about it. He goes into the kitchen to shut it off because he smelled the burning. And just at that moment, somebody comes to the door, the milkman, or I believe it is the milkman who comes to the door. And, you know, they're in a quandary. He's in the kitchen. And what is he going to do? And the whole sense of the fraught danger of it and his terrible sense of guilt that he had put them all at such risk when he was here just trying to do something just to really help them.
Right. That's one of the great scenes where, so it's actually some milk she leaves burning and then the fish seller shows up and fish is sort of rare deal at this point, and so they don't want to send him away because then he won't come back. So not only does he come to the door, but Marie has to invite him in, and he's stuck downstairs in the kitchen. So what are they going to do? And the scene after that is really wonderful because they're all trying to reestablish their dignity. On the one hand, he does, as you say, feel terrible and feels guilty. But, you know, he also wasn't doing anything that crazy, and she did leave the milk to burn. And so she, on the other hand, feels like he's criticizing her when he's the one who put them all in danger. It's this very complicated scene. In general, with Nico, although I've been emphasizing how much Hans Carlsen talks about the Dutch couple, of course you do get a lot of great passages about Nico's sense of conflict and dependence, and he feels grateful, but on the other hand, you can't feel so grateful to someone without restoring a little bit of your own dignity in one way or another, whether it's by keeping the cigarettes as a secret or something else. I think I was thinking about this recently, that, you know, Death of the Adversary is a very dark book where there are villains and where there's evil. And so comedy in a minor key, in contrast, you know, why is it called comedy? In a way, it's a comedy because it does work out for everybody as best as could in the situation. And what that means, especially for Nico, is that all the characters keep their dignity. This is such a book about when you're in a difficult situation or when you're in an impossible situation or horrible things are happening, what kind of arrangements do you make with yourself or with other people in order to, you know, be able to keep going? And for Wim, the Dutch husband, taking in this Jewish refugee is part of what lets him continue to feel good about himself. And for Nico, keeping these cigarettes secret are part of what lets him carry on. And for Marie, there's so many examples of, at first, not really fully understanding what Nico's going through. And then after Nico has died, she does start to understand more and more. And as you say, kind of imagine herself in his shoes. After he dies, there's this wonderful passage where it talks about how disappointed Marie is because it's been so difficult keeping him here. And so to keep them going, they've had this little daydream about the war being over and the three of them strolling out of their house arm in arm and all the neighbors looking and seeing that they've had this man in hiding the whole time. Everyone would recognize from his Jewish face and from his pale skin that he's been in hiding. And they would get to stroll proudly down the street and have a feeling that they personally had, in their small way, won the war. And, of course, now this will never happen because he's died of pneumonia. This is the passage that Francine Prose quotes as this wonderful example of humor and complexity and this sort of sad but ultimately powerful insight that he has into the fact that, you know, everyone has mixed motives for everything.
I wanted to make an observation about something. Personally, for me, I had my own little revelation in some way, like Marie did, while reading this book. As I told you before we began this interview, my father had sheltered a young man during the war in his apartment for 3 years, from 42 to 45. And there was a certain point at which the Gestapo found out about the apartment. My father had to leave, which is why he ended up in the United States. Ultimately, he had to flee occupied Holland, and everybody had to go someplace else, including this young man. And there's a description in that I got from other people that this young man had been terrified. You know, he was just one of these people who could not mask his terror to be outside. I mean, he was only 14 when he actually was taken in. So he was quite young. And people were worried about him because they felt that, you know, he looked very Jewish and he looked very scared. And so he was a kind of liability. And the sense that I got as people talked about him was, you know, it wasn't very nice in a way, the way they were talking about it, as if there was something wrong with him to be so terrified. And in Hans Kielsen's book, Comedy in a Minor Key, which you, Damien Searles, has so marvelously translated, I finally got the sense of what it must have been like for this young man, and I really got the sense of compassion for him that I had not felt before because I hadn't heard it from others.
That's a great story, and I've heard similar reactions to both of these novels of Hans Kaufmann, both the one I found and translated, and then the one that was reissued, Death of the Adversary. People, myself included, you know, have heard all these things before and you know the facts of these kinds of stories, but Kaufmann is able to really make you feel what it's like on the inside, and not in an incredibly dramatic, beat-you-over-the-head kind of way, but in the way that feels like what life is really like, where, you know, things are complicated and your feelings don't come with labels that tell you what it is you're feeling. There's all these different emotions and ideas and complicated reactions to things that go on in your mind. But underneath that is your core as a human being who is, you know, feeling these things and responding to these things and just reacting as best you can, whether you're in hiding, whether you're someone who's sheltering someone, whether you're someone who's decided not to, whether you're a Nazi, whatever you are, you're still making your way through this jungle of feelings and thoughts about things. And something about Kaufmann's writing is able to not tell you about that, but just put you there.
That was translator Damien Searles talking about Hans Kaufmann's novel, Comedy in a Minor Key, in an interview we recorded in 2010. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.